Shoot the Defence, the best podcast in the world. We're at it.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, and send in a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. It's my top five matches. I'm your host, Stel. And my special guest this evening is Manchester City Academy coach, Ian Fitzpatrick. Ian, welcome to the show, mate. How you doing?
Hi, yeah, good, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, all good, all good. You done podcasts before?
I've done one or two in the past, but not for a while, so I'll see how we get on.
Ah, ring rust, eh?
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, look, before we talk about your top five games, mate, I heard you played at United. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate to be involved in two of the biggest clubs in the Northwest. So I grew up there as a young academy boy, went through the ranks, started, I think I was around about 9 or 10, and then finished off when I was about 20, 21. So I had a decent time there.
You were at Littleshaw as well, no?
Yes, I was, yeah. Yeah, I was, yeah. I was very fortunate to spend 2 years there to be selected to go to the national school. In and around some great coaches and some great players and some wonderful experiences. So yeah, it was a really sort of enjoyable part of my career.
So who was in your class or your year?
Oh, right, yeah. So in my class, we had Alan Smith, Fanny Jeffers, mm-hmm. Scott Parker, Stuart Taylor, big goalkeeper. Yeah. It's a decent group. And then I think the year above me, we had obviously, there was Michael Owen, Wes Brown, Michael Ball, some popular names there. And then obviously below me was with the likes of Joe Cole and various other players. So across the sort of the time I was there, I was in around some really talented players.
Yeah, sounds like it, blimey. When you look at Littleshaw back then, I know obviously they've got St. George's Park now, and I know a few other people that played, that were at Littleshaw back in the day, Leon Knight, Daniel Nardiello, and a few others.
Yeah.
What do you know about St. George's Park, and what's the difference between Littleshaw and St. George's Park?
It's a little bit obviously it's different, you know, it's a lot more high-tech, a lot more professional the way it's done because of all the technology and all the resources they have now, but Littleshaw was an idea around getting the best 2-3 players from all the clubs in the UK, in England, and then putting them together in an age group. So we used to go for regional trials, Northwest trials, and used to have Southwest trials and various trials around the country, and then eventually you'd get selected to be in your sort of like in that year group of 16 players. So you'd have players from Arsenal, West Ham, Man United, Liverpool. Tottenham, all players coming from everywhere that would form a group, and so it was quite unique in the way they designed it. And then obviously you would stay there for 2 years and you'd train during the day, some days go to school, some days, and you'd sort of mix sort of like a hybrid timetable. And it was really, to be funny, it was really really good. And obviously you had some superb coaches, Keith Blunt and John Peacock, and there was a lot of time on the grass, which was, you know, really sort of developmental in them age. St. George's a little bit different. I think when they moved to the teams or the clubs sort of took over and decided to do it themselves. So I don't think they have the contacts as what we had. Does that make sense? Whereas we almost formed like an England team at under 15s.
Right.
And became that team and trained as that team on a daily basis. Whereas now the club's sort of, you're just released for a few days here and there to St. George's. So that was probably the only thing that is different. Obviously staying away from home at 14s, 15s as well. Under 14s, 15s, 16s was a big thing on your development. And it sort of, it made you grow up faster. So yeah, it was in that sense, it was challenging but very rewarding.
The thing is, when you were there, did you have an inkling as to it being abolished in the future? Because I know that there was a lot of tension back then between the FA and professional clubs and the schools' FAs. So yeah. Did you have a rough idea, or did you have
not while I was there? No, it was probably masked when I was there because you were too busy. You was playing in tournaments, or you was travelling, or you was playing games. You train every day, and you were only a kid, so you wasn't exposed to probably what was going on in the backgrounds. I mean, the only thing that you could probably say is that it was a really successful model. You know, if you look at all the players that have come through at Lillishall and actually become professional footballers, well, especially the big name players, you know, it did have a history of producing two or three every year group of top players. Now, whether clubs that played in, you know, full-blown international level, whether clubs are doing that now, I don't know. If they'd be successful, I'd probably have to see the sort of data on that, but we didn't have an idea at the time especially when I was there, no idea it was going to sort of end. You just kind of like, oh well, every year we're producing two or three players, so why would you change the system? But then obviously the idea around clubs could do it themselves, protect their own sort of players and their own assets, I suppose, and that took over.
Fair enough. And just one more question related to United.
Yeah.
I was listening to another podcast the other day, a fellow called Kenji Gore, who's Dean Gore's son. And yeah. He was at United's academy and he was released by the club. Yeah. But he was saying the day that he got his release, he actually met Sir Alex Ferguson, went into his room, and Fergie was sat there, legs crossed, saying, you know, this isn't the club for you. We'll be halting your progress if you signed a year contract here. It's best to go elsewhere. Did they treat you with the same amount of respect?
I don't know. Yeah, I suppose he did, but it's a difficult one to talk around, really. But at the time, I was sort of a young pro there, so I remember getting one of the coaches shouted, I think it was Jim Ryan at the time, said, or Neil Bailey, did the gaffer once wear you upstairs? You think, oh God, the gaffer once, what have I done? Very rarely do you get to speak to the gaffer because you're so busy with the first team. Mm. And he called me up and he says, you're going on loan to South Africa, to a site called FC Fortune, which was...
Queen and Fortune team, right?
Yeah, wow. So it was a part of the deal between when Queen and Fortune came over, something had gone on where they were building a club in Cape Town or something, so I was sent out there for a year. And then obviously things changed when I came back. Upon hindsight, I probably should never have gone, but it was a wonderful experience. But I suppose when you're told you need to go out on loan, you don't turn around and say, well, no, I don't think I can. You can't go, okay, that's fine, no problem. I'll trust your judgment.
Right, okay, that's fair enough. So just tell me about this experience in South Africa, because obviously we had the World Cup out there. How long ago was that? Blimey,
2010,
yeah, blimey, it's been that long. Crikey. And we heard all these stories of kidnappings and whatnot, and fortunately, times have changed. It's probably not happening as frequently as it was back then, but let's be honest, when you went out there, did you go on your own? Were you with other
players? I went with another player, a lad called Paul Wheatcroft, who was at the national school with me at the time. He sent the two of us out on loan, out for the season. And obviously, you know, we were well looked after, in the sense of the apartment or the place we were staying was great. And you know, everything, like the football provision, you know, wasn't at the level of what we were used to, but it was different, and, you know, everything's an experience. The training schedule was different. We'd train at night and we'd play on certain nights and weekends off purely because of the weather and the environment. But apart from that, you know, the safety aspects were listen, I think it's, if you stick to the right areas, you're okay.
Yeah.
I think if you go off the beaten track and you go into the wrong zones, I think you're exposing yourself. And that's probably no different than major cities in the UK. If you stay to the right areas or the places that you know are safe, you'd be okay. If you wander into the wrong zones, you could have a problem. So we were quite aware of what we had to do and how to behave when we was there. Fair enough. It was an amazing experience. When I look back now, I mean, you know, with what's going on in the world at the moment, and, you know, in all this time off to sort of sit back and think about things, you know, you look back and now you go, wow, what an experience, you know, 19, 20, 21, whatever it was, playing over in South Africa, you know. Crazy times.
And that's a football mad continent.
Oh yeah, it was. I mean, we'd turn up to games and there was thousands of people there, thousands. Just, you know, probably without even any tickets, just turn up and watch, and it was just, yeah, it was an eye opener. But you know, football's football. You just want to play, don't you?
Yeah. That's right. And play you did, which we'll find out later on in the episode. But let's go to your top five matches, mate. And I'm glad you mentioned two of these games because it's from my favourite World Cup, Italia 90. Yeah. And just like you, yeah, it was the tournament that kind of introduced me to football. I vaguely remember Mexico 86. I was five. Yeah. I don't remember too much. I remember a couple of little bits here and there. But yeah, Italia 90 definitely was the one. And England 1, Belgium 0 is the first one.
Famous... I mean, reason why when you said choose the games, I thought, well, I'm going to have to choose something that sort of inspires me, you know, yeah, that made me want to become a footballer. And I think that World Cup 1990, I think running home from primary school and just waiting for the games and the build-up and the hype. And I remember at the time, I was only like 9 or 10, and, you know, the England team were getting a little bit of stick and they weren't great. And when they were going into the tournament, no one knew what was going on, and the games were coming, and you're there with all your family watching the games, and it was just an amazing World Cup. And that, I think, was it the first game when Cameroon got beat Argentina?
Yeah.
You know, shocked straight away, and it was madness. But it was a period or a tournament that really sort of made you just want to go in the garden and play all day.
Yeah, that's right. And no disrespect, right, but England's group, good teams, England, the Dutch, Republic of Ireland, Egypt, but it was a crap run of games, wasn't it? Honestly, they weren't really that entertaining.
No, they weren't. I think they started slow, and, you know, it was just, I was watching it on TV and the Gascoigne documentary on Netflix, unbelievable it was, and you know, it just sort of brought flashbacks of, you know, that game when they played Belgium, and in the last minute, that pass from Gazzard, that the free kick to Platt, David Platt, and he's just done that unbelievable volley in the last minute, and that from that moment, it sort of like spearheaded the team forward. They played Cameroon and Germany. It was just an amazing period.
Mm. Well, what I remember about that game is Belgium hit the post twice. They had Koolemans in the first half and Enzo Schifo, who's one of the most underrated players I've ever seen, hit the post in the second. But both teams kind of restricted each other to shots from range. I mean, Proudhon didn't have much to do, neither did Peter Shilton. And then on comes David Platt for Steve McMahon, an aging Steve McMahon at that. And David Platt, you know, young Aston Villa, who I think he spent some time at sea as well, didn't he? There you go. And he scored this absolutely incredible volley from Gazza's free kick. And it was the turn and volley as well, wasn't it?
I know, yeah. I mean, the weight of the pass was unbelievable. Yeah. But the ability to turn his body and almost like not see it for a second where it's blinded because he's coming from behind, and then to catch it so sweet and then to send it in the direction of the goal. It was outstanding. I remember being in my living room with my dad and my brother, and it was just like the roof came off the house, and it was like the last minute, and everyone was running around, and it was crazy times.
Yeah, that's right. So what else made you choose this game, mate?
I just think it was a moment in my life that I was thinking that, you know, what made me want to become a footballer, and I think that tournament and the success behind it, and I think, and then I watched obviously the Gascoigne documentary last month, and just brought flashbacks of being like, God, I wish I was 10 years old again. I wish I could just, you know, start again. And that game, I just think it summed it up. It sort of like, it really gave energy to the tournament after winning that in the last minute. And it was like a really sort of big thing for the team.
Yeah. Well, look, before we talk about the semi-final, for me, this World Cup was the best, not just because it was my first World Cup, but you remember so many different moments from it. Okay, there are other World Cups with standout moments, but, you know, I could tell you René Higuita against Cameroon. Obviously, England versus Cameroon. There was the Rudi Völler incident with Frank Rijkaard. See?
It's crazy. They got Lothar Matthäus. It just makes them driving runs and smashing balls. And, you know, you don't see goals like that from distance very rarely anymore.
No, not at all.
You know, people having the bravery to shoot from 25, 30 yards. And Lothar Matthäus and Ruud Gullit and all these top players, you know, Rijkaard, like you were saying, and that Rudi Völler incident. And then, the opening game where Caniggia, you know, the Caniggia run where he's dribbling, he gets tacked down and his boot comes flying off. It was just, for me, Italia 90 was just an outstanding World Cup. It was something I remember anyway, massively.
There's a podcast coming out soon called Vingera, and it's about the World Cup, and they interview people like Pierre Littbarski and whatnot, so I'm really looking forward to that one coming out.
But, all right, brilliant.
Yeah, so that'll be a good one. But yeah, it's just, wow. So yeah, we'll talk about the semi-final then. That was another game. And I'm not ashamed to admit this, but my cousin bought me a West Germany shirt. he bought it for me. He was 16 at the time. Right. And that summer, we went to Cyprus, and he gave it to me while we were out there. And me and him, we were wearing it in Limassol. My dad goes, take those effing T-shirts off. We're going to get absolutely battered here, because obviously many tourists in England had lost to the Germans. But again, another memorable game. And, probably more notorious, not for the penalty shootout, but for Gazza's tears.
I mean, that tackle, I mean, he's already on a yellow anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, the tournament. So he knew that before the game, obviously he's speaking to the changing rooms, players know, look, if I'm on a yellow, I better not get another yellow because I missed the next game. But I just think he was so wired up for the game and so emotionally involved that once he's seen that ball there to be won, he wasn't stopping, was he? No. And I think at the moment he did it, he knew, and that's just it's a famous, iconic moment, isn't it, when you see his face and Lineker turn around to, obviously, the bench, the dugout, and you could see him, and he's getting really upset. So, yeah, it was powerful, really powerful.
But the more I watched that challenge, the more I watched the build-up to it, because the Germans were just playing triangles around him, and he's chasing it like it's a rondo or something. And you could just tell he's got so frustrated that, okay, fair enough, he's, as you said, he is exuberant, he is excited, but...
Yeah.
Boy, there was no need to make that tackle whatsoever. No,
in his documentary, he openly speaks about that. And he says he didn't even touch him. And I suppose if you slow it down to frame by frame, he doesn't actually touch him. He does make a meal of the German player. But again, it still was a very risky challenge to make. But yeah, it was a crazy time. Yeah. Crazy moment for him.
And the thing is just on the subject of Gascoigne, he did it in the 91 Cup final a year later. And he almost ended his career doing it.
I know. Some tackle that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Bloody hell. I think Gary Charles still got stud marks, isn't it? But back to this game, mate. So Andreas Bremer hits a free kick which deflects off Paul Parker. And I know Paul very well, and there's nothing he could have done about it, to be honest. He did what he had to do, and he was just unfortunate.
The only thing I used to say is, why has he turned his back? But it's just one of them, you just sort of like turn your back, it's just glanced off your back of your side, and it's just looped over, and it's gone so high and above Peter Shilton. And I was thinking, surely Peter Shilton could just tip that over, but he's falling back and it just drops in, and it was like...
Yeah, I think if Shilton was 5 years younger, he probably would have saved that. But then Gary Lineker equalises.
Equalised.
Was this a game where he actually pooed himself? And it was.
He says he did. Yeah, he said he did. Yeah. And in his one of his comments, definitely.
Yeah, I couldn't remember if it was this one or the Cameroon game, but because I remember he was like scraping his backside on the turf like a dog would do on a carpet, there you go. So,
Must have been nervous.
Exactly, yeah. So, 1-1, goes to extra time, then penalties. The Germans, obviously, incredible when it comes to penalties. And
just like machines, aren't they?
That's it.
You just know, if you're having a penalty shootout, you don't want it against the Germans.
No. I can't remember them actually ever losing one, but, Pierce has his one saved from Bodo Jorgen, another fantastic goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Then it comes down to Chris Waddle, and I don't think Chris Waddle actually ever took a penalty in his life, did he?
No.
Prior to that?
No, he didn't. And you just knew when he put it down and he walked back and he's run up, he just knew that this was just going into row Z.
Yeah.
He was just left-footed, he was just going to smash this ball, and you just knew it had wings on it. Yeah. And as soon as he hit it, it just went into orbit. It was crazy. It was like, oh God, it was 10 years. I was heartbroken. I think it took me all summer to get over it.
Well, yes, I can imagine, mate. But the thing is, I think the confusing thing about this is that he was so good at dead ball situations, wasn't he? Free kicks, corners, but from the spot, 12 yards out, you're kind of expecting him to at least hit the target.
I was fortunate enough. I played against him a few times.
Oh yeah.
When he was towards the end of his career, I think he was playing for Worksop. And he used to play a few times. And even sort of when he was older, he was just just the ball was just used to stick to his feet, his little chinks and his turns, and his delivery was outstanding. And you could tell that, you know, what the ability that he had, how good he must have been when he was in his prime.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Absolutely. Okay. So one more question. Why this one then? Since it upset you so much, right?
I just think it's one of them games where you just like, you're so engrossed in the build-up, and it's like the semi-final, and it's like such a massive thing at 9-10 years of age, and it's like we could be in the final here, and then with the Gaza thing, and then the, obviously Lineker equalising, and then obviously the drama behind the penalty shootout. It's just one of them games that you just, you don't forget. It's just there. It's a real, it's a moment in, especially in my history, growing up as a kid, that it's just, it was a special game. So yeah, that's why I included that one.
Fair enough. Okay. Right, the next game, you selected Stoke City against Halifax Town, FA Cup replay.
Yeah.
You're at Halifax at the time.
Yeah.
We're looking at, what year was this, 2001, I want to say? 2001?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah, around about that time, yeah.
Okay, now, you lost that one 3-0.
Yeah.
So, what was it about this one that made you select it?
I just think it was, you know, we played them at the Shea in the first leg.
1-1?
Yeah, it was 1-1, and it was it's one of those games where when you go to the Shea, it's a fantastic club. It really is. It's a real footballing club, but it's even better when a good team comes or a bigger team comes, because obviously the fans turn. There's more fans. There's more attendance. There's more noise. So it just feels that extra special on the night. And it was a really close game, and we played so well. And I think in the last couple of minutes, I think Paul Harsley equalised, and we just knew that we've got the replay here. And obviously financially that's massive to a club like Halifax at the time. So we had to wait our 2 weeks, and we trained, and we had the build up, and we did a lot of work preparing for it. And we got to the Britannia Stadium. We had all the pre-match stuff, and it was a good turnout. And it's just, you know, it's always special to play in the FA Cup against Stoke City. And you know, it was a really nice stadium at the time, and you know, it was a good turnout from the fans. It was just one of them games where you just sort of, it was not just the one game, it was the combination of both games, the build-up in that period. And you actually convinced yourself that you could do well and you might have a chance here. But it was just one of them games where, obviously, they're obviously a better team, higher calibre of squad and players, that the pitch seemed massive when we was there. It was like, just the pitch got bigger.
It's quite windy as well there, isn't it?
It was a tough night. It was a tough night, but we gave a good account of ourselves over two games, and decent little run in the FA Cup. But it was good. It was a great experience. I was only about 21, 22 at the time, so to play in that was really, really good for me.
Mm. And you're up against Gunnarsson at centre back, weren't you?
Yeah.
So he was a bit of a tough one, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a big guy. He didn't take no prisoners. But I think, like, you know, the higher you go, I mean, it's these players, they're just a little bit more physical, a little bit sharper, just better all round. I mean, I remember going through the ranks when we used to be at United, and I was a reserve there, and, you know, we used to, on Champions League days, you know, Fergie used to say, right, we're playing Juventus, and the reserve, so we would set up as Juventus, and we'd play against the starting 11 that were playing Juventus. So, you know, trained against the likes of Yap Sam, Ronnie Johnson, Henenberg, and they were just man mountains. They were huge. You used to think, how the hell are you ever going to get past these people? And then you get past Yap Sam, and you'd have Peter Schmeichel, who was a man mountain. It was just the physicality of these guys was so big. Such a presence on them.
How did your apprenticeship or your... I don't know, your studying or your career at United set you up for your current role?
As a coach now?
Yeah, from the coaching perspective, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose, I don't know. I think, you know, obviously growing up through the ranks of Manchester United, you're around the, you know, I was there when it was a really successful period.
Mm.
Premier League wins, FA Cup wins. It was, you know, we sort of just won the treble as well that year. They flew us all out to Barcelona to watch the game there, and it was just, I don't know, it's just one of them where it was a really attacking club at the time. Everything was about attacking and taking, not worrying about what the team is and making sure that you're technically good and you'll deal with yourself, and, you know, good teamwork and hard work, and I suppose good values and good things. That's where the way I've been brought up, and that's the way I'm now, and that's probably the way I coach now, is to have similar sort of traits and characteristics as what I did when I was a young player.
Mm.
Well, that's what excites me in trying to coach kids today. I think that's what I look for straight away.
Well, you see, this is the thing. I know a lot of youngsters these days want to make it as pro footballers. Obviously, that's why they're in the game. But I don't know if they want it for the right reasons. And by that, I mean, we see a lot these days, a lot of footballers relying on social media and, you know, the sponsorships and the adulation. But it just seems to me that back in the day, well, I say back in the day, back in when we were younger, it was mostly about playing the game more than anything.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think, we've got to understand, you know, technology's had a massive shift in the way social media and the way football has, and it's just changed. Everything's changed about it. The Premier League's changed. You know, the stats, the data, all the technology, it has changed from when we was around. You know, we was more focused on training and hard work and that type of mentality. There wasn't as many distractions. I think it's tougher now for kids because of all the distractions and all, you know, straight away you look in your tablet and this and that and your phone, and it is a lot tougher. But yeah, it's, you know, from when we were growing up, it was just a case of just get on the pitch, train, work hard. Mm.
It's very interesting you say that, because I spoke to Ramon Vega yesterday. And I asked him, if COVID-19 existed back when he was playing, would the footballers be more disciplined than what they are today? Because obviously we've seen the likes of Kyle Walker and also Jack Grealish get into a little bit of trouble. And he basically said, well, look, times were different back then. It's more difficult from now from a psychological perspective because you've got social media, you've got all these other... But it's interesting because a lot of the older generation will say the youngsters have it easy from an academy perspective because they don't have to clean the toilets like apprentices did in YTS. So it kind of works both ways, doesn't it? It's not like balanced. It's almost as if it's either one or the other for either generation.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but I think the bottom line is the end product is still the same. If you're good enough, you will make it. If you're good enough, you will play. You know, whether from whatever era you're coming from and whatever way you're brought up, I think if you're a top academy player, you do find your way to play to the top, regardless of what era you come from. I mean, I did all the, you know, cleaning the changing rooms and being, cleaning boots and doing all that type of things. And the academy players don't have that now. But the accountability is still being a pro is still the same. You know, if you're told to go and play in a first team, you still got to deliver some way.
Excellent. One more thing on Halifax Town. You had Andy Woodward and Neil Redfern there. What was it like having Neil Redfern in and around the club?
Oh, wow, what a player.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. You know, when you think, honestly, he was just a really nice, honest, hard-working guy. You know when you watch these Netflix box sets and you've got like Vikings on and you have like a lead character who's like a warrior? That's what he was like. He was just up for a battle. He could play, he could mix it, he could do everything, he could box to box, he could shoot. He was, you know, wonder why he's had the career he had and the clubs he's played for. And I think he came to us towards the end and he actually managed for a period of time, but from the experience of playing with him and you know, being managed by him, he was fantastic.
I remember him at Oldham and at Barnsley.
Did a bit of Palace and various other teams, and
that's right,
yeah.
And he was just one of these.
He's played Premier League as well, so you know, anybody's played Premier League for the years that he's played and scored goals.
Yeah,
in the Premier League as well. It just shows you the level of player he was.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he was wasn't he caretaker manager at Halifax at some point?
Yeah, he was. He was a caretaker, but then he took over for a period of time. He became manager for a period of time as well.
Oh, wow, blimey, because he was at Leeds as well, and I think he's at Liverpool Women. So, he's done pretty well for himself, to be honest. That's some CV, to be fair.
It is. It's a fantastic CV.
There you go. Right. How many games we've done now? Three or four?
Three.
Okay, I'm losing count now. I think we got so engrossed in other conversations, I'm losing count of the games. So, which game do you want to go with next, mate?
Probably one of my favourite games is obviously the Champions League final, the couple season final.
There we go.
It was just an unreal sort of experience, I think, for all of us, because we were sort of reserve players, and fortunately the club decided that, you know, they're going to fly everybody out. That's something that Manchester United is really good at doing, is to fly the whole organisation basically out for the game. And I remember we all went out and we all had to wear our suits, and we were staying in Barcelona for the day, and it was red hot, and the build up for the game was, everyone was excited, and, you know, we had to get the underground tram to the stadium, and when you get to the actual stadium, the Nou Camp, it's like, wow, it's just so imposing and impressive. And the atmosphere was electric. It was just unbelievable. And we're all, you know, just watching the game, and obviously we go, you know, the 1-0 down, and then it was just them two goals in such a short period of time, in that right at the end of the game. It was unreal. It was just an unreal experience.
So where were you sat during the game? Were you with?
We were sat with all the players.
Oh, okay.
We were all sat together, but we were behind the goal quite high up, and I remember. The first goal was what went in. It was Tedeschenko, wasn't it? He scored the first one, was it?
Or, right.
Yeah, he scored the first one, and we were still celebrating that goal. we were still jumping around, and we didn't even realise that they got the corner and scored again. It was like they just scored again. It was like, it was crazy. And then, you know, after the game, all the players were running up to lifting the cup up, and it was just an amazing time.
Mm. So, who would you say at the club, in terms of a senior figure, do you think you learned more from?
I was fortunate enough to obviously train and being around them all the time, because it was different in them days. You know, it was like you'd have A and B teams, and when you become a reserve player, you were like, that was the second sort of tear down from the first team. It wasn't like EDS is now in the way they are, the makeup of it now. It was like we used to have reserve games, and sometimes one of my reserve games would be you'd have Solskjaer playing or David May playing, or it'd be made up of five or six players that hadn't played on the Saturday. So Fergie was really big on, if you didn't play weekend, you played in reserve. So that actual reserve team sometimes would probably finish in the top five of the Premier League at the time anyway.
Right.
So you're in and around all these top players all the time, so you're constantly learning. Obviously Beckham was outstanding, you know, you used to watch him, and Paul Scholes, his passing range, and Giggs, his dribbling. You're in all of these players. But I think the player that sort of I learned the most from was Teddy Sheringham. He came late and had a season with us, but because he was a striker, and we used to do finishing on every Wednesday. All the strikers used to sort of like do finishing sessions, and he was really supportive. He was really really good towards the young kids, and he was just, he always talking, always trying to educate you while you're doing your training. So yeah, I'd probably say Terry Sheringham.
Yeah,
was quite influential to me. Yeah. Anyway,
that doesn't surprise me. I remember Teddy Sheringham when he was at Millwall, then he went to Forest, Spurs. Yeah. So he played not only under some fantastic managers like, you know, yeah, Ryan Clark.
It was surprising because he'd just come in. He was quite old when he came. I think he was in his 30s.
30, yeah.
And it was a bit of a surprise. I'll tell you, Sheringham signing for United. He'd come from Tottenham, and as soon as he came, he was just, you know, obviously the first team is slightly different. They're on a completely different programme and schedule to the reserves. But he was always dead pleasant, dead nice, that, you know, he's always open to, you know, that you could approach him about anything. He was always joining with your training, so yeah, he was really sort of a refreshing sort of person. He was excellent towards the young kids.
Yeah, I think he cost United £3.5 million. Yeah,
£3.5 million.
Can you imagine all those players in the past? You think of Cantona, £1.2 million, Keane, £3.75 million. It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. You've got players now going for on average 50, 60 million.
Yeah. You know, Peter Schmeichel, £500,000.
That's madness.
Bye. Right. Final game? Do you want to... Because you had a couple of... England under-16 games, no?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So I think when we speak about the EFA National School before, we had one or two games there that sort of stick out in my mind. I think one of them was we played Germany, and we played them in Berlin,
mm-hmm.
and it was the Olympic Stadium.
Oh, right, okay.
And
okay.
Obviously, you go over there and you do your training, and the Olympic Stadium's quite a historic sort of venue. Fantastic stadium, great setup. And we found out, I think, 2 days before that they were giving all the primary schools in the area the day off to come and watch the game. So it was like a national thing. So we turn up at the stadium, we get ready to play, and there's 75,000 there.
Yep.
So, you know, you're 16 years of age, you're playing in front of 75,000 people, and the noise was deafening, and it was just amazing. And they had all he had all the security around the pitch, and in them days he had the Alsatians, and uh-huh. it was really imposing. And I just think the whole idea behind the, you know, travelling and staying and seeing what Germany's like, and then playing in this amazing stadium with all these fans at such a young age was really it was an important game to me. That, even though the outcome wasn't great, we got played off the park. I think we got beat 4-0. but in terms of just sticking out in your mind, just the noise and the venue, it was a fantastic time.
So what year was this roughly, would you say?
I would say 96, it would have been 96, 97, surely. 96,
yeah, so that was before the stadium was renovated. So
yeah.
When you're looking at players that you faced, what German players do you remember?
I probably can't even remember. There was probably that many. They're probably a bit similar to us, where only one or two would make it from a squad anyway.
Right.
To be household names. I mean, they played against when we played Spain. They scored against Spain, but Casillas was in net. So that was one.
How old is Casillas now? He's got to be
39,
same age,
yeah. So
you might have scored against him.
Yeah. We played Spain and a crew in a little sort of tournament in the Czech Republic. We're in it as well. And who was the player that played for Arsenal?
Rzyzicki.
Yeah, but Rzyzicki, playing in a little tournament. So we had like a little three-team tournament.
Spain,
Czech Republic, and so we played against Casillas, and Rzyzicki were playing for them teams. So, yeah, it was, I'd have been around 96, 97 as well.
So Casillas made his debut for Real Madrid about 2 or 3 years later.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
So he must have been ready at that
point. Oh, yeah, he was... You could tell he was a top keeper then.
There you go.
He was outstanding.
There you go. And you scored past him, so you go.
Yeah, I've got it. Yeah, I've got it on video, so that's one I've got.
I don't think many footballers can say that, to be fair.
No. Well, it's only a tapping at the time, but it all counts.
Listen, they all count, exactly.
Yeah, they all count, yeah. Tommy Jeffers went on the right. He squared it across, and I sort of like slid in, and I think it came off my shin, and just sort of went in the bottom corner. So, yeah, it was... I'll take that one.
Well, listen, Wayne Rooney shinned that volley against City. I don't know if he's complaining.
It's the old red kick.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wish I had a shin like that.
Fair enough. Right. Before we wrap this up, mate, there's one thing I need to ask you. Tell me about, and I want to get this right because I've done a bit of research, World at Your Feet.
It's like a little sort of private academy. We do some community stuff, some coaching community stuff in Prestwich, it's in Manchester. It's good, and a couple of the coaches coach girls' teams and various other teams, and work with a grassroots club and do the coaching there. So it's a real community-based coaching stuff. So, yeah, it's good.
Mm. And have you seen the number of girls participating in football increase since the World Cup?
Definitely. I think obviously at City as well, you know, the women's section, I think it's really refreshing, and the growth in the sport now is it's taking off. And I think it's definitely filtering down into the grassroots.
Well, that's good to hear, because we hear a lot of horror stories about grassroots and the lack of funding. And, you know,
yeah,
I've spoken to other people from different countries, and they tell me that the problem that they're having out there is, again, the funding. You got a lot of kids whose parents can't afford to pay $1,000 or £1,000 a year to pay for kits and that kind of stuff. So you got kids that obviously come from poor areas that can't participate as a result.
Yeah, it is tough. I mean, I think when I remember growing up, I think it's probably the same for you. Grassroots was a big part of our sort of football makeup. So was primary school football. There was always seemed to be like a primary school teacher. You'd always have good school teams. You'd be training after school, training for your schools. You'd be training for your grassroots teams and playing. And there was a lot of football, whereas I think now with education and the way it's gone, there's not much football at school anymore. And I think especially at primary schools and also at grassroots level as well, that, you know, the resources are not great. You know, the pitches aren't great for these kids. You know, my son's I've been watching him since he started playing at sevens and eights, and he's under 14s now, and some of the pitches you go to, yeah, they're good, and then some of them you go to and it's like, wow, I mean, how can this even, they're just trying to play, but it's like on a cow field.
Yeah.
You know, there's no toilets there, the nets are falling down. It's like, come on, surely these county FAs can invest more, the FA can invest more in terms of just providing better facilities and better equipment to make it a little bit more enjoyable for them, or a little bit more practical for them.
Well, it just makes you wonder where the money's going. Just makes you wonder.
I know it does. I mean, and you know, even if you could build like hub centres where it was like an AstroTurf, every county could have, you know, something where it's 3-4G where they could share on a road to where they have the, you know, the pitches and be able to play and try and play the correct way. Some of these pitches, it's like a tractor's gone over them.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you've got the likes of the Football Foundation, and I don't really know their role. I mean, the last time I actually heard anything of them was 10, 15 years ago. I know they've revamped the charity, or revamped the organisation, and they've got a nice little website. But in terms of what they do for grassroots, I don't know. I don't know.
I know, it is tough. I mean, because it's a massive sport, and there's a massive intake in terms of the amount of kids that play football from the age of 5, 6, right the way through to, obviously drops off as they get a little bit older, but the amount of grassroots teams and the amount of teams that play and the amount of kids that play, you know, boys and girls, it is probably a mammoth task. It is a difficult task. But I still do believe that, you know, better facilities, better resources could be available for these kids. I think in turn, then you'd get a better intake or a better opportunity to develop players as well. You know, if you go to Holland and these types of places and Belgium, they're all geared up for, and obviously they don't probably have the size of the scale of the players that we have, but they seem to have all these AstroTurf pitches and these good local community facilities. And, you know, you go to ours, it's on a field in the middle of nowhere, and it's just like it's crazy, some of the pitches. But it is a big task. I don't know how they would how it's dealt with.
Well, I tell people who haven't been to the Johan Cruyff Arena or the Amsterdam Arena that outside there's a little tiny, I'm going to say it's like a 2-a-side pitch or a 3-a-side pitch just for kids. And it's like little markings, that's all it is. But you've got benches around there so the parents can obviously watch their kids kick a ball about. So even prior to kickoff, before the kids go into the ground, they can still have a bit of a kick about. And I think it's just a community thing as well. We don't seem to have it as much as they do out there, you know?
No, we don't. Definitely not at the grassroots level. I mean, it's difficult for me to, I can't really speak too much about it, because I know there's a hell of a lot of good work that goes into a lot of these clubs. But just from my experience of being around my son, who's come through 7s, 8s, 9s, 10s, up to 4, he's going to under 14s next year, I would say at least 60, 70% of the pitches that they play on are not fit for purpose. And if that's the case with him, it must be the case for majority of boys that are playing in the system. So it'd be nice to see if there could be some type of investment or strategy in place that could really provide a platform for these boys that are academies, the opportunity to try and play on a decent venue.
Yeah. See, the argument I've had with a few mates about, you know, the progress of the English football national teams, I've always said we haven't had enough players play their trade abroad. We've seen Beckham, we've seen McManaman, yeah. Owen, etc. Yeah. But in terms of the big names like your Lampards, your Scholeses, they haven't gone abroad to play for them. Probably they haven't had to, let's be honest. Yeah. But when you look at the likes of Jadon Sancho, who's doing remarkably well in the Bundesliga, and I believe that our younger players need to go abroad to develop their skills technically. Now, I'm not saying we're not good enough out here to develop them, but it just seems that, I don't know, the Germans, the Dutch, the Belgians, they seem to have this magic formula where they seem to squeeze a little bit more out of their players. I don't know. Maybe, am I right? Is it just...
It's a tough one, isn't it? It really is a tough one. Are they doing something? Is it less demanding? Is it easier over there? Is the Premier League tougher? Is it harder to get into the Premier League squads? You know, because the level is higher. There's probably a whole range of factors that could affect it.
What about player attitudes, though? Because again, it seems to me that when they go abroad, there's much more discipline and respect, whereas out here, as I've said before, as we mentioned, there've been a lot of younger players who kind of take what they've got for granted.
Yeah.
I'm not putting you on the spot here, Ian, sorry.
No, I mean, I can only speak from my experience of when I came through as a young pro. It's tough because I presume that over in foreign countries as well, especially the top sides as well, there is that element of pressure still in demand. You still, and it goes back to what I said before, you know, if you are good enough, you will find a way of making your way into a first team somewhere. Obviously, you have to take into consideration the aspects of timing and luck. There's a lot of, that's a big part in breaking through is, are you in the right place at the right time, and I've got the look. There's a lot of luck that is needed as well. There's a hell of a lot of good work that goes into the academies. Now, some of the academies in the UK at the moment, and the way they're training and the things that they're doing is fantastic in terms of development. So I wouldn't know, because I don't really see what foreign academies are doing or what foreign teams are like. So it's just that, it's that old one again, isn't it? That same way, if you are good enough, you will make it. But there is probably more distractions in the UK, socially, I would say.
Well, do you know what? You kind of half answered a question I was about to ask next, and that was about academies abroad. And if you'd have spoken to any academy coaches from abroad about their styles and whatnot.
I mean, obviously, we go on, we have a lot of tours and games and things like that. I just think that, you know, especially the sort of more popular clubs, they all do try and play a good way of football. They want the best concepts, and they want the kids to do really well, and they want them to develop technically. And I think that's clear to see whenever we play foreign teams, that they're trying to do similar stuff to what we do in terms of, are the kids enjoying it? Are the kids learning? Are the kids getting better technically? Are they demonstrating that they're doing all that in the games? And they seem to do that as well. You know, you don't see many teams anymore when, especially when I was growing up, where it was win at all costs and, you know, and things where it's just crazy. There's a lot of good practice that goes on out there by a lot of good coaches and a lot of good clubs. That's definitely something that I've noticed.
Fantastic. Well, mate, thank you ever so much for your time.
No problem at all.
Really, really enjoyed talking, especially about Italia 90.
Oh, God, yeah, what a time. Bring it back.
I'd like to send you a YouTube link for the BBC review of the World Cup.
Yeah, please do.
I was watching it the other day. It's brilliant. I think it's like 47 minutes, but it's immense. I think I might watch it again before bed. But yeah, before I let you go, is there anything you want to promote? Have you got Twitter or any Instagram?
No. Let's just bring football back. Let's get it back on TV. Let's just hope that, you know, this period passes and everyone's safe and well, and we resume our duties.
Absolutely. Well, guys, that was Ian Fitzpatrick. Ian, thanks for your time.
No problem, mate. Take care.
Thank you very much. Guys, still listening, give us a follow on Twitter at Shoot Defence. We also have an Instagram page, same name. So until next time, take care.